Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe, and producer, Gus Cadavero. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. And this is not a strictly academic exercise. Our aim is to help Americans think critically about U.S. foreign policy so that we can develop the policy that best serves the interests of the nation and its people. I'd like to begin with the important shift in U.S. policy which may be taking place with regard to Syria and Russia. First, let's take a look at how the U.S. got into its current situation. In 1989, the Soviet Union, led by Mikhail Gorbachev, found itself bankrupt due to its effort to compete with the U.S. military buildup under President Ronald Reagan and due to its disastrous war in Afghanistan. In a series of bold moves, President Gorbachev withdrew from Afghanistan, ended the half-century-long Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe, turned the Soviet Union into a voluntary association, legalized non-communist parties in Russia, and held free elections. Since Ronald Reagan had developed a close relationship with Gorbachev, one wonders how the U.S. might have reacted to these developments had Reagan still been president when they happened. However, Reagan's successor, George Bush Sr., saw the retreat of the Soviet Union as an opportunity for a U.S. military expansion focused on the oil-rich Mideast. In early 1991, under George Bush Sr., the U.S. invaded the Persian Gulf, displacing Iraq from Kuwait, which Iraq claimed as a province. While the U.S. did not invade Iraq at this time, it placed an economic embargo on the country and repeatedly bombed Iraq over a period of years. The 1991 U.S. invasion also led to the establishment of a large, permanent U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf. 10 years later, George Bush the Younger significantly furthered the policy of U.S. military expansion in strategic oil regions with his 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, the site of important future pipelines, and his 2003 invasion of Iraq, a leading oil producer with many as yet undeveloped oil resources. Although President Obama bowed to Iraqi Shiite militia pressure by withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq, Obama, for the most part, continued the policy of U.S. military expansion with his escalation in Afghanistan and his overthrow of the Libyan government. In the Libya campaign, we note, the U.S. used jihadist fighters, a tactic also employed in Syria. Additionally, President Obama drastically escalated the efforts of Bush Jr. to destabilize the government of Syria. In 2010, Debka, the Israeli intelligence newsletter, reported that U.S. surrogates, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, were bringing jihadist fighters to the Turkish-Syrian border to insert them into the country to overthrow the Syrian government. While the so-called moderate Syrian rebels recruited by the U.S. sputtered, the Islamist militants grew into the radical Islamic State that now threatens to take over both Syria and Iraq. The war has proved a political mess as well as a humanitarian disaster. Millions of Syrians have become refugees in a multi-sided struggle involving not only the U.S., ISIS, and the Syrian government, but also Russia and Iran, who back the Syrian government, and Turks, who fear the regional Kurds. Most recently, Russia, an ally of Syria, has significantly increased its military support for the Syrian government with combat aircraft, tanks, and additional troops. Marshawn, could you please give us some details on the aircraft and other weapons that the Russians have brought to Syria and your thoughts on how they might affect the military situation there?
The first thing to look at is the raw numbers. The Russians deployed approximately 28 fixed-wing aircraft, at least that we know of. Again, this is largely based on satellite images and reports that have come in from those speaking off the record. It's hard to say exactly, but at least from what we understand from what Jane's Intelligence Review, one of the premier news agencies regarding military intelligence, has said it was approximately 28 fixed-wing aircraft, about 12 Su-25s, 12 Su-24s, and 4 Su-30s. The Su-25 is a fixed-wing, air superiority, multi-role aircraft. Now, what this means is it's an aircraft that can provide both support to ground troops, close air support, but it's also capable of providing air cover. So while it can attack ground targets, it's also capable of air-to-air battle. The same thing with the Su-30. The Su-30 is also a multi-role air superiority aircraft and designed to engage in ground support as well as air-to-air combat. Now, one of the things that strikes me is the fact that 16 of their aircraft are designed for air-to-air combat. ISIS does not have an air force. So it is an interesting take on the fact that they deploy so many aircraft designed for air-to-air combat. Now, the Su-24, of which they deployed 12, is specifically a close air support ground attack aircraft. It's similar, in a sense, to our A-10 tank busters. It's designed to fly in real close, real low, and hit ground targets in support of infantry. These aircraft can be a real game changer because it provides the Syrian army with close-in air support and then Russian military advisors on the ground that may in fact already be engaged in ground combat, as has been reported in a couple of Russian news agencies, and has been suspected by those on the international stage. They now can provide accurate close-in ground support, which is something ISIS does not possess and can really be a real equalizer in terms of the overall fight between the beleaguered Assad army and ISIS rebels.
And what about the helicopters?
The Russians also deployed, at least as far as we understand right now, and again, these numbers are changing. Supply flights keep coming into Syria, so I'm sure these numbers are going to continue to go up. But at least right now, what we believe are there are 6 Mi-24 attack helicopters. Now, these helicopters are interesting because they're capable of flying in and launching quick attacks on ground targets and then flying off and disappearing, but they're also troop transports. Now, these aircraft were used very successfully by the Russians in Afghanistan against the Mujahideen. In fact, this is one of the things that precipitated the U.S. deploying Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen, or should I say selling Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets, because the Soviets, they would attack Mujahideen positions with these aircraft and then using the same aircraft, turn around and land paratroopers of the Russian VDV, or the Blue Berets as they're known, behind the Mujahideen. So they'd cut off their route of retreat, so they'd hammer them from the air and then be able to throw troops directly into fight before the enemy had time to regroup and recoordinate. It was highly successful until the U.S. introduced the Stinger missile. So these helicopters are most likely not simply for defensive purposes, but they do add a bit of a tactical edge, especially considering that the Russians have deployed in the ballpark of 1,000 Spetsnaz Marines. Now, these Spetsnaz Marines, or if they had also deployed VDV, again, paratroopers, again, we're not certain, but either way, Spetsnaz Marines or VDV, they could fly them into the fight, hit ISIS, and come directly into the fight where it counts in support of the Syrian army. So again, these are a game changer, make no mistake.
And Marshawn, in addition to the fixed-wing aircraft and the helicopters you just discussed, I understand they also brought in something called the Cornet anti-tank missile. Could you talk about that?
The Cornet, it's a laser-guided anti-tank missile. It has what they call a fire-and-forget system, kind of like how crockpots have a set-it-and-forget-it. This is a fire-and-forget-it. Basically, what you do is the weapon will paint the target with a laser. You fire the weapon, and then you can pretty much forget about it, and the missile will head towards the target. It's very similar in a lot of ways to our Javelin. It can be fired by a two-man infantry crew that can bring the weapon into battle, or it can also be mounted to armored vehicles such as the BMP-3 or the T-90 battle tank, both of which have been deployed to Syria. It is a weapon designed to knock out main battle tanks, and it has been battle-tested. It was used by Iraqi special forces against the U.S. military when we invaded Iraq in 2003. It had knocked out several Abrams tanks and several of our armored personnel carriers. Again, there weren't specifics. I'm not sure whether they were Bradleys or M113s or something like that, but they have been able to knock out our armor. And then in addition to that, they've also been used during the 2006 Lebanese war by Hezbollah, in which they had knocked out several Israeli Merkava tanks. Now, this is very significant because the Abrams and the Merkava are considered some of the best tanks in the world, and the fact that a two-man crew with one or two of these could knock out an American-made tank or an Israeli-made tank is very significant. ISIS does have a small tank force, largely captured from the Iraqi and the Syrian army. So again, it's a force, it's another force equalizer. And there is a precedence for the use of anti-tank weapons to negate an enemy's tank advantage. If we look at the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, what is known as the October War in the Middle East, or the Yom Kippur War in Israel, what we saw was that the Egyptians initially neutralized the Israeli air defenses with their surface-to-air missile systems because the Egyptian Air Force was destroyed from the 67 war. It had never really recovered. So they neutralized the Israeli Air Force from the ground, then crossed the Suez. And when the Israelis counterattacked, instead of going tank for tank, they set up anti-tank missiles, and they utilized those to knock out the Israeli tank force. And again, these were a very, very early predecessor to the Cornet. It was called the Sagar, which was wire-guided, not laser-guided, but a similar principle, two-man operated. And they used these to knock a really bad hole into the Israeli armor units and actually force them into retreat. Why is this significant? This is a significant example because it demonstrates how what the Russians are bringing to the Syrian army are not just numbers, but are force multipliers, are weapon systems that can make up for what is now currently the lack of numbers in the Syrian regular army and can really deal a very devastating blow, not only to ISIS, but to also the other rebel forces in the so-called Free Syrian Army or the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda incorporated in Syria.
March, does ISIS have any anti-air capability either that they may have gotten on the open market purchased or from captured arms? For example, they captured that very large cache of weapons and Humvees and tanks that they have been parading around.
Absolutely. They have brought down several Syrian aircraft. What we believe is they may possess either Stinger missiles or Chinese or Russian variants of similar design. Mm-hmm. There had been a report that had been passed around Al-Arabiya, and this is going back about a year, that was saying that ISIS had bought on the black market from the Chinese their equivalent of the Stinger missile. Yeah. And so they do have some anti-air capabilities, and this can pose a threat to particularly the Su-24, which is flying in really low to provide ground support. But it's also significant that the Russians deployed large quantities of these aircraft. It is believed, though the Jordanians claim that their pilot crashed because of mechanical failure, ISIS claims they shot it down. We'll never really know since neither side wants to tell the truth on the matter because it's going to embarrass one or the other. The fact is that if they did bring the aircraft down, again, demonstrates their potential to bring down advanced aircraft. But the Russians are deploying so many that they may feel if they fly in squadrons, not just in onesies and twosies, but they're flying in relatively large squadrons, it can increase the survivability.
Right.
So a lot of this depends on what ISIS is fielding, whether it's a coordinated effort, because so far they haven't knocked down any of the U.S. aircraft, and they haven't knocked down any of the British or Australian aircraft. So it is possible these aircraft will be advanced enough that they might be able to fly high enough and evade ISIS anti-aircraft capabilities, but certainly does pose a threat to the Su-24, which is flying it really low.
One quick question about the Stinger missiles and stuff. Do they require heavy training and technical sophistication to be able to use them, or is it the kind of thing that you can capture and pretty much someone of an ISIS fighter capability who is basically part-time taxi driver be able to pick up and fire accurately?
It's the kind of thing you probably would require some kind of training. I mean, when we gave them to the Mujahideen, we didn't just hand them to them. They received training in refugee camps in Pakistan and things like that. Now, they might not have been trained directly by U.S. operatives, but more likely than not, they were trained by the Pakistani ISI, who would have been familiar with the weapon system. It's also worth noting that much of the ISIS leadership, much of their cadre, comes from Saddam's former army. They're not just going to give something like a Stinger to the part-time taxi driver. They're going to give it to somebody who was priorly with Saddam's intelligence or Saddam's special forces who would know how to operate the weapon system. Because absolutely, if you give it to somebody who has no idea what they're doing, they may be able to figure out the Chechens had used them to bring down Russian helicopters on occasion. But again, those were very rare incidences because by and large, the Chechens were not trained to operate that kind of weaponry. And it is a sophisticated piece of machinery.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and producer Gus Cantavero. And we've been analyzing and updating you on the developments in the war in Syria, and particularly the fact that Russia has brought some substantial new aircraft and other equipment to Syria to aid in the defense of the Syrian government against the insurrection by ISIS and others. Now, Marchand, the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes on the ISIS positions in Syria. How effective have they been? When will the Russians start to participate in airstrikes? And will the combination be sufficient to defeat ISIS?
Well, right now, we're not exactly certain when the Russians are going to participate, but it is clear that pretty soon they're going to, because these aircraft aren't just being deployed to defend the port of Tartus. For those who don't know, the port of Tartus is Russia's only naval base in the Mediterranean. Now, what's very important to the Russians is that Assad stays in power, because the loss of Assad and the handing of control either to ISIS or the Free Syrian Army or collection jihadists like you had in Libya would be disastrous, because the Russians would lose their only toehold in the Mediterranean. And Russia's always had an interest in having a influence in the Middle East and an influence in the Mediterranean. So the Russians are going to have to start contributing soon. But it's clear from what the aircraft they're flying in, these aren't purely defensive weapons. It's a system designed to not only defeat ISIS, but also to guarantee a certain element of security for Assad. Again, ISIS doesn't have an air force, yet they're deploying aircraft that are designed for air-to-air combat as well as ground attack. It is also worth noting that Russia is delivering to Syria S-300 surface-to-air missiles. Again, they claim this is part of a previous contract, but it's important because the S-300 is capable in theory, and again, it's never been tested against U.S. aircraft, but again, it's in theory, it is capable of shooting down U.S. aircraft. The Russians, on the one hand, have an interest in beating back ISIS. On the other hand, they also have an interest in making sure the West doesn't decide to suddenly topple Assad. So it does back the West into an awkward position. I think very really, these could be a game changer. The Russian troops are very well trained. What they're deploying are not just your ordinary conscript soldiers. They're deploying elite units such as the Spetsnaz Marines, such as SOBR counterterrorism units, such as possibly VDV airborne detachments. These are very highly trained, very highly specialized units. And so they can be a real game changer on the battlefield, but not just against ISIS, also against the pro-US allies. And that's where the use of the S-300 and the use of these air-to-air jets comes in, because and President Obama has made the statement that he will bomb Assad's forces if they attack the Free Syrian Army. Now, we really don't have that option anymore, because now we run the risk of either getting our aircraft shot down by the Russians or accidentally bombing Russian troops or engaging Russian aircraft. So really, it's neutralized our potential to protect the Free Syrian Army while at the same time dealing a death blow potentially to ISIS.
Now, Marshan, has been the U.S. policy really since 2010, 2011, to overthrow the government of Syria. The Obama administration seems to be indicating it's backing off a little bit from that adamant position that the Syrian government must be overthrown. It's been reported that Secretary of State Kerry is reaching out to Russia with a view towards some kind of military cooperation in Syria against ISIS, and it's implicit that in these conversations that the United States may be now willing to let Assad stay in power for the time being, although in the long term, we would like to see a new government there.
This just proves that John Kerry has been listening to our show, right?
It could be, because as our listeners know, we have been from several months pointing out that the logic of Syria is that the United States should be cooperating with Russia and with Iran, allies of Syria, in defeating ISIS, because we share a common antipathy towards the jihadists. Now, Marshawn, do you think that there is a tilt going on, a change in policy where the U.S. is going to become more pragmatic and start to work with Russia in fighting the common foe of the jihadists?
Possibly, but what we've seen coming out of John Kerry, at least in recent days, has been almost a doublespeak. On the one hand, well, maybe we should cooperate with the Russians. On the other hand, telling the Russians your actions are destabilizing the region and creating the potential for a east-west confrontation. In reality, there is a lot of doublespeak going on. It's hard to tell what is genuine, because we haven't stopped our support for the Free Syrian Army, who are bent on toppling Bashar al-Assad, Russia's ally in the region. We also haven't stopped our kind of wink and nod, turning a blind eye to the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. Is this a real change of foreign policy? Are we trying to cut a deal? The key is that this is a direct challenge to U.S. influence in the Middle East. It's a direct challenge to the United States, the same way as Russian involvement in the Ukraine was a direct challenge to the West and a direct challenge to the U.S. In order, if we were to establish true stability in the region, this might be a deal that the Russians would be willing to consider. We would have to sit down, or should I say President Obama would have to sit down with President Putin and say, all right, I understand. You want to keep Bashar al-Assad in power. You want to keep the port of Tartus. Fine. We're going to divvy up the Middle East between us. Because what we're seeing develop is a sort of Cold War era environment with spheres of influence. Now, what kept the peace during the Cold War is that we relatively accepted each other's spheres of influence. Again, we poke and prod each other in places like Vietnam, in places like Afghanistan, in Africa, you know, places like Angola, Zimbabwe, South Africa, places like that. But in reality, we didn't go headlong into each other's spheres of influence. And we have to remember that the most important thing to the Russians is maintaining their national security, because they have a perpetual fear of being invaded. And while to us as Americans, it might seem a little unrealistic, you know, we know NATO is not going to sweep into Russia, you have to remember that there are people alive today who remember the siege of Leningrad, the siege of Stalingrad, the battles of Kharkov and Kursk. So for them, the idea of being invaded is a very real one. But that's also why throughout Russian history, during the Great Game, when the Western powers were all grabbing for colonies in Africa and Asia and whatnot, the Russians were concerned with fighting the Turks and grabbing for territory along their border, because creating a buffer zone is essential to them. If we can give the Russians the sense that, look, we'll respect your buffer zone as long as you respect ours. Ukraine, we don't care about Ukraine. You cross into Poland or Estonia, we'll have problems that will hit you in the mouth. Same thing in the Middle East. You can have Syria and Lebanon and Iran. We will control Iraq, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. And then this way we create, once again, as we had during the Cold War, a balance with spheres of influence, as Harry Truman successfully did with Stalin. Now, it doesn't mean we're not going to poke and prod at each other, but prevents a wider conflict. What we have to worry about is the fact that we aren't willing to cut a deal right now. And that's when I look at John Kerry, I feel like he's talking through both sides of his mouth. On the one hand, saying, let's work together. On the other hand, still giving guns to the Free Syrian Army. We might not like Iran. We might not like Russia. And certainly Bashar al-Assad is not a nice guy. Neither is Vladimir Putin. ISIS is a greater threat. We allied ourselves with the Soviet Union because Hitler was a greater threat. Didn't mean we liked Stalin, but it meant that we knew we could deal with Stalin later. We had to deal with Hitler now. It's the same thing with ISIS. We can't fight everyone at the same time. We have to pick the bigger threat. And right now, Bashar al-Assad is not threatening to nuke New York. ISIS is.
Marchand, you've been talking about Russian aircraft and missiles. What about the war on the ground? There have been reports that there are British special forces in small numbers on the ground fighting ISIS. Perhaps we have some agents in there, but nothing that's public information. We have U.S.-trained so-called moderate rebels called the New Syrian Forces. And Gus, you recently brought to my attention how effective or not effective they've been. Could you talk about the U.S.-backed New Syrian Army?
Yes, they are especially ineffective. The second group was even less effective than the original members of the New Syrian Army. The New Syrian Army, which was started out with a group of 54 and ended up with only four or five remaining, the rest of them having run away and abandoned their posts. In this second group, there was a total of 75 of them in total, and they immediately crossed the border and handed their weapons over to Al-Qaeda in exchange for safe passage and favors for protection for the family. Anybody who follows this with any level of sophistication knows that the people in that area gravitate towards the people who can provide security for their families, the people who can provide jobs, security, money, food. That's what makes it go round, not AK-47s and grenades.
And I think we've been trying to build this so-called army for something like 4 years, and now you're talking about 70 to 75...
Job well done.
70 to 75 members who immediately surrendered.
Yep. And imagine how much money it costs
you
to
make
train
this
them,
stuff up.
Feed them, clothe them, provide them with a sidearm, a rifle, and all kinds of supplies. And all they do is turn right around and hand them over. Anas Ibrahim Obeid of Al-Qaeda, he says he plans to issue a statement repudiating the U.S. training strategy. And Obeid told Al-Qaeda he tricked the U.S. coalition because he wanted their weapons. Ironically, he would have been one of the top-ranked New Syrian Army forces left after Lieutenant Colonel Mohammed al-Dahir resigned this week, complaining the program was not serious.
Well, Marshawn, it doesn't sound like a serious army.
And that's, by the way, that's by Jason Ditz.
What needs to be done on the ground in addition to these efforts that might be made in the air against ISIS in order to defeat ISIS? Is the Syrian army itself capable of handling the ground fighting against ISIS and other rebel groups? Is it necessary for Russian or American or Iranian troops to be involved in the fighting on the ground?
Absolutely, it's necessary to have ground troops, because one of the reasons why this so-called New Syrian Army falls apart and every effort we make falls apart is because at the end of the day, what they're looking at is, if I support the U.S., my family's going to get murdered and we're going to lose because clearly these guys are a bunch of imbeciles.
Sign
I mean,
me up.
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, if it's so apparent to us, it's even more apparent to them. So that's why they defect and join ISIS. This is why they defect and join the al-Nusra Front, because they're looking for the winning side. Mm-hmm. Now, the Syrian army has been hanging on by its fingernails, but what's been helping is the fact that the Syrian soldier in the what's called the Arab Syrian army, they look to their left and they look to their right, and what do they see? They see an Iranian Quds Force soldier. They see a Hezbollah fighter, and now they see a Russian soldier. That emboldens them because they say, I'm not alone. This isn't a hopeless fight. We can win this, because they're seeing help. Now, it's very important psychologically. If we were to, let's say, go into, take Iraq, for example. Let's say we were to go into Iraq and we were to support the Iraqi army. We wonder why is Iraq look at Iran and Russia as its friend? Because if, let's say, the only people doing any of the fighting right now in Iraq are the militias. And the reason is because they're fighting not for money, but for their families and their homes. So they're fighting in a trench, and they look to their right, and they look to their left. They see an Iranian soldier. Who do they assume their friend is going to be? Not those jerks who drop a few bombs and then disappear. They're going to look to their left and right and say, well, Iran's my friend. It's the same thing with Russia, and it inspires confidence. Now, if we were to put boots on the ground, I know nobody likes this. Nobody likes this. But if we were serious and we put boots on the ground and the Iraqi soldier, the Syrian soldiers, to look to his left and his right, and he was to see Americans, he'd go, America's my friend. America is the one that stands beside me. It would not only demonstrate that the U.S. is a friend who, as we used to in American history, we stuck by our allies. If we demonstrated that kind of loyalty, not only would it inspire our allies to keep fighting, it would show them that the war is winnable, it showed them that we are committed, and it would demonstrate that we are committed enough to win this fight. And certainly a combination of American firepower plus the fighting spirit that the Iraqis and the Syrians have shown, we could defeat ISIS. Our training, our technology is much greater than theirs. But the fact is, at the end of the day, a jet cannot take a hill. A jet cannot take a city. Jets are great support. I'm not knocking the Air Force. But the fact is, at the end of the day, you need boots on the ground to take and hold territory. And 53, 54, 56 new Syrian army personnel are going to look around saying, there aren't enough of us to take a city. I'm not an idiot. I'm not going to go get my head cut off.
I think,
you know?
Now Gus has a question.
I was just going to say, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I think that ship has long sailed, because the reputation that America has around the world at this point is like someone with a gambling addiction coming to you and saying that he has a great investment opportunity. No one takes him seriously anymore. And even the Shia militia has said so many times that they're going to fight in our stead against ISIS, but should America come back into the fight by putting boots on the ground, they'll turn and fight against America. So like, there really is no possibility of that being a winning situation outside of a full-scale invasion. And we saw how that turned out already.
If the ISIS in Syria is defeated by a combination of the government forces and Russian and Iranian forces, what leverage does the United States have in that country? Isn't that a predicament for Washington?
The average Sunni Muslim living in Syria, living in Iraq, is not a fundamentalist militant. But the fact is that they are looking around, and ISIS are the guys with the guns, and a lot of them don't like the fact they're dominated by a Shia government. So the Russians sweep in, they defeat ISIS, and a lot of Sunnis are going to look to that and say, well, Russia's an impartial entity that has come in. They've defeated ISIS. They provide actual security. Well, you know what? Russia is our friend now. And governments like those in Baghdad, those in Damascus, are going to tie themselves to Russia, because the reputation now Russia has is that it stands by its friends. It's the same way that the president of Egypt, General el-Sisi, sticks by Russia. He's asked for U.S. help in fighting ISIS in the Sinai, and we've said no. But on the other hand, Russia has agreed to sell them arms. In exchange, they want a port in Alexandria. Well, for the Egyptians, that's a no-brainer. Give them the port, we'll get the guns, and we'll be able to fight ISIS in the Sinai. Long term, this cements Russian influence in the Middle East. And one of the things that's interesting is I saw a picture of a protest that took place in Damascus, and people were holding up portraits of Bashar al-Assad and Vladimir Putin. And imagine if you're living, let's say, in Raqqa, for example, which is ISIS's de facto capital, and one day ISIS is thrown out. The shackles of ISIS tyranny, which, because ISIS is a barbarous regime, like I say, anybody who had a choice would not want to live under ISIS. And that's why we have so many defectors leaving ISIS. if you were to live there and you saw that you were liberated by Russian and Syrian troops, your immediate reaction would be, Russia's my friend. Russia's the kind, because Russia liberated us from this tyranny. Whereas what did the Americans do? The Americans have done nothing to liberate us. They've dropped a few bombs, but they didn't liberate us. It was a Russian soldier who came in and liberated us. So from the perspective of the average Syrian, particularly average Syrian Sunni, Russia represents stability. It represents not being oppressed either by a Shiite minority or being oppressed by a militant Sunni organization. So for Russia, politically, long-term, this is a brilliant move. And we really have missed the boat, as Gus pointed out. But then our choices become very slim. Do we completely disengage and tell the Russians, listen, you do this? Or do we try to hop on the bandwagon with them, hoping that maybe we can divvy up the Middle East a little bit like we did in Eastern Europe?
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator and producer, Gus Cadavero. And we've been talking about the Russian buildup in Syria and its implications for U.S. policy. Now, Gus and Marshawn, could you please remind me, why were we so committed to overthrowing the government of Syria?
That's a good question. We were, because there were alleged chemical weapon attacks that were used against their own people. I believe that was the original impetus for Obama coming out and making a big grand stand and saying that there was a red line and that he was going to send in the Air Force immediately. But just because he was a nice guy, he was going to let Congress vote on it, right?
The Syrian government, and we don't really know who was doing the chemical weapons, was already embroiled in a struggle that we incited back in 2010.
Right.
So what was our strategic interest in 2010? And overthrowing the government of Syria? We also use the pro-democracy argument.
That old gag.
Right, which, as we've talked about with war after war, there's a nominal reason which is put forth by our government or any government when it attacks another country, which is for public consumption, but then there's a real reason.
Yeah, it would seem to me that, I say it sort of tongue-in-cheek what the reasons are because they're not serious. The reasons that they give are just sort of to put something on the newspaper and, you know, get people excited about it. Or get their enthusiasm behind it to say that it's just or it's justified and it's moral. But that's never the case. And it seems that these flimsy, fraudulent cases that are made before the people fall apart over time. People give up on them. And then even the people who came up with them at the beginning, John Kerry and Obama and Hillary Clinton, they back off of them over time because they know how flimsy they are.
And of course, George Bush Jr. was trying to undermine the Syrian government with supposedly pro-democracy movements during his administration. Yes. We often go back to that famous interview with General Wesley Clark by Amy Goodman, in which General Clark, who was commander of NATO, top U.S. general, talked about seeing right after 9/11 in the Pentagon a list of 7 countries that were targeted for overthrow by the United States. He was totally astounded. The ultimate prize on the list was Iran. Syria was also on the list, Syria being a close ally of Iran. If the goal, the ultimate prize is Iran, the largest fossil fuel energy country in the world, with a possible exception of Russia, then it would have been strategically useful to take out Syria so that Iran didn't have a friendly country on its side when we went after Iran. That's the only geopolitical rationale I can see for trying to overthrow Assad.
Yeah, and Israel hates Syria.
Israel, our top ally in the region, hates Syria. And Syria has been allied for many years with Russia and provides Russia, as Marchand has noted, with TARDIS. It's only a Mediterranean port. That's a logic I think should be presented to the American people. Would they buy it? I think they're given pro-democracy. They're giving other reasons. But would they buy
this rationale?
That would
at least be truthful. Go ahead, March.
For whatever the original reason was, I think now, especially in 2010, as we saw with the resurgence in Russia, you know, we had the 2008 Georgian War, where Russia invaded its neighbor because Georgia was trying to exercise its control over the separatist regions, which were pro-Russian, ethnically Russian too, and Georgia believed it was backed by NATO, and then Russia came in and smacked Georgia in the mouth. So I think one of the things you start to see in the Middle East is it's become about Russia. Whatever the initial reason was, whether we're talking ensuring our control of the Middle East, whether we're talking about ensuring friendly regimes, whether we're talking about getting control and securing the oil reserves, whatever the original reason was, I think it's become primarily about Russia because we want to ensure that Russia does not gain dominance in the Middle East. Because you're absolutely right. Russia is one of the world's largest oil reserves. Iran is a Russian proxy. Iran doesn't make a move without Russia's go-ahead, because Russia is what has kept Iran's economy afloat for, you know, in the bad shape that it's in. It's still kept Iran's economy afloat, supplies Iran's military. Iran, Syria, we are looking at a proxy war right now, which we're getting pretty close to coming to blows, either intentionally or accidentally, with the Russians, because these proxies represent a potential for Russian dominance. And, you know, people always slag off the idea of, oh, well, natural resources aren't important. Natural resources are essential, because if Russia were to control the entirety of the Middle East, they were to control Iran, if they were to control Syria, if they were to gain influence over Iraq, they could pressure Saudi Arabia, they could gain political dominance in Saudi Arabia. And if they were to gain control of the Middle East, they would control the most important oil reserves in the world.
Of course. And it's not just
their own, but now the Middle East.
And it's not just about, the oil game is not just about getting enough oil for your own people. It's about denying your rivals access to oil.
Weakening them.
Yes. Weakening, exactly, which is worse, why we took over Libya to deny China access to Libyan oil.
The reason why Europe has been so reluctant to get involved in Ukraine relative to the United States is because all the natural gas that goes into Europe comes from and through Russia. Russia has the power to shut off the lights in Berlin. We were to find ourselves in a position where the Russians control the Middle East, we think $2.15 is expensive for gas. If the Russians decided, America, you're not playing ball with us, they could jump our prices up to $5, $10 a gallon by just shutting off the supply of oil. I mean, we remember the OPEC crisis.
Speaking of pipeline routes, that's why Yugoslavia was important. And although Clinton did not start a war in the Middle East, he did preside over the war in Yugoslavia, which broke up that country. We now have a very large military presence in one of the republics of the former Yugoslavia. That area is very important for pipeline routes.
And that's one of the reasons why Putin has been really cozying up to the Serbs. He's had troops training in Serbia. He visited Serbia for one of their national days and presided over the military parade in Belgrade. We see how much the Russian economy is hurting from the sanctions. What's going to not only keep it afloat, but put it back on top, or put it on really on top for the first time in modern history, put it on top and in charge of the global economy, will be if they can control the world's access to pipelines and oil. Russia can then now dictate terms to everybody else, because just like the Europeans, if we know that the Russians have the capability of shutting off our access to oil, it would completely damage our entire way of life. And that's why if you look at where Russia's getting involved now, Russia's getting very heavily involved in places where there is oil and places where the pipelines are very important.
Marchand and Gus, it seems to me that there might be, perhaps this is wishful thinking, a rethinking of this expansionary military policy, a rethinking of our animosity towards Russia, as evidenced, for example, by the Iran nuclear agreement, by our recognition of Cuba, by what may be a shift in our military strategy in Syria. Do you think there may be a shift in our attitude towards Russia? Also, Gus, I'd like you to talk about the possibility that at least certain elements within the Republican Party are calling for a new attitude towards Russia. First, do you think there's a shift going on within the Obama administration?
Definitely. There certainly is a shift happening here. It's happening on the heels of a kind of a disastrous couple of years, foreign policy-wise, where we've seen Syria, Ukraine, Iran, where it's come close to war with Iran for many years. And all of these things are connected by Russia, and especially Cuba, you mentioned, the lifting of sanctions on Cuba. All of these are connected to Russia. I think I mentioned several months back about the Iranian negotiation that it looked like it was actually going to happen. And I said, I wonder if Russia is asking for this gimme in exchange for helping out against ISIS, because obviously Ukraine is a very tenuous situation there. And it's escalated, but then sort of stalled a little bit, the American involvement. And the funny part about it to me is that it seems like America is coming to the table saying, now, Russia, look, it's not because we can't win. It's because we have absolutely no idea what we're doing. Because every time we back somebody, they turn out to be an utter catastrophe, right? I mean, yes. You're looking at the right sector in Ukraine. You look at the new Syrian army, al-Nusra. It's a complete disaster. Every place we touch turns into a literal hellhole.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing the shift in policy, is because very clearly our military policy right now, again, short of putting boots on the ground and engaging in direct combat in Ukraine, in Syria, I think they're trying to fight on the diplomatic battlefield, because I think the idea is that if we bring the Cubans in, if we lift the sanctions, open the embassy, maybe we can get them onto our side and get them to evict the Russians from Cuba, because they've expanded and grown their military installation, their intelligence installation in Havana by thousands of personnel. Part of what I'm wondering is that because we can't so far beat the Russians on the military front, like you said, every time we have tried so far, the people we backed have either been like the right sector, total neo-Nazi nut jobs, right, or an abject failure like the new Free Syrian Army. I think what we might be hoping to do is draw these countries out of the Russian sphere and into ours. No matter how much we try to get the Cubans to like us, they're still going to see Russia as their long-term friend, because right, Russia was their friend long before we were. And same thing with Iran.
And all of these countries are going to say the only reason America relented is because we had Russia behind us. So they're never going to come over to our side. They're just going to see us as someone who eventually backed down.
Exactly. And they'll know it was because of Russia.
Right.
And again, Russia has proven loyal even through the fall of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. It has still stuck by its allies. It didn't acquiesce to its military installations in Cuba, nor did it completely abandon Cuba. And the same thing with Iran. So they look at Russia as a long-term loyal ally. Like you said, they see us as weak because we're coming to the negotiating table because of Russia. We're not coming to the negotiating table from a position of strength. We're coming to one from a position of weakness. We're also proving to be sort of ne'er-do-well allies.
Yeah.
We support certain people when it's convenient, but as we demonstrated from Iraq, the moment you're in trouble, depending on how politically convenient it is for us at the time, we either will support you or we'll just leave you to your enemies. Whereas Russia's demonstrated that regardless of the situation, whether it's just sending arms or whether it's sending troops, they will support their allies, because Russia always has a very long-term political vision. And that's one of the reasons why the Russian state has survived so long. It survived the catastrophic collapse of the Soviet Union, because they look in very long-term manner. Whereas on the other hand, the United States, we tend to look at things in a very short term. What is the immediate gain we can get out of this? Mm-hmm. And that's what happened like in Afghanistan. We backed the Mujahideen. Then afterwards, the Soviet Union left. We washed our hands and the country fell into civil war. And so many of the Afghans turned and said, America, you helped us kick the Soviets out. Now help us establish order. And we said, nah, it's your problem.
Well, we have political ADD. You know, we're on exactly to the next topic, the next, you know,
and
next week.
And of course, there is a rationale to American foreign policy, a modern foreign policy, whether it goes back even to the Spanish-American War up through our coup d'etat in Iran in 1953, in Guatemala in 1954, our oil wars. It's the agenda of large corporations that have an enormous amount of influence over public policy. Mm-hmm. And that influence and their objectives do not coincide with the national interest or the interest of the American people necessarily. Yeah.
And look at the short-term memory of the American people, like that political ADD that I just mentioned. You know, the 1953 overthrow, and then was followed in, what, 72 by the reversal?
Well, when I think 79, when the Shah was thrown out.
Of course, yeah. 79. So the 79 is not very long ago, but the American public basically says to Iran, come on, get over it.
Yes, we saddled the country after a night CIA
a brutal
coup
dictator
in 1953, Operation Ajax under Kermit Roosevelt, who was Teddy Roosevelt's grandson. We overthrew the democratically elected government, Mossadegh, who'd been to the United States. He went to Philadelphia, mm-hmm, and was hailed as a great leader. And then we soon thereafter overthrew him in a CIA coup d'etat.
He made the mistake of nationalizing the oil.
He nationalized the oil. And again, that was British Petroleum came to the CIA.
And said, fix this.
Just as copper companies and Pepsi-Cola came to Nixon in the early 1970s, and they said, we got to get rid of Allende, who was a populist, a socialist, democratically elected leader of Chile, and we threw him out. Well, this is not the interest of the United States. This is the interest of some narrowly focused profit-making corporations.
No, we would have been much better off leaving Mossadegh in charge.
Oh, sure.
I mean, much,
sure,
much better.
And Allende in Chile. And look at the people we make it as allies. There's a big hue and cry because the Saudi ambassador to the United Nations has been given an important job in the UN Human Rights Commission. And the Independent, the UK Independent, reported that Saudi Arabia is widely recognized as the largest violator of human rights in the planet,
right,
with other thousands of beheadings.
Every year they set a new record for beheadings.
Some poor guy is in jail in Saudi Arabia. He's been sentenced to 1,000 lashes by the whip with a whip for blogging about free speech.
For blogging?
For blogging about free speech, he's going to get 1,000 lashes of the whip. And these guys are allies?
Yeah, that's the kind of company that we pick.
And you know, this isn't a, listeners should understand, as we often say, this is not a conservative liberal issue. It's not a Democrat, Republican, because we all have our different points of views on this show, and they don't fit lockstep with any party. But as Gus, as you've been...
I was going to say, the United States is like the Don Corleone of democracy. They surround themselves with dictators and horrible people.
Before we continue, I just want to remind listeners, if they just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator and producer, Gus Cantavero. Now, we've been talking about the Syrian situation, the possible change in our relationship with Russia, and it's interesting to note, as you brought to my attention recently, Gus, that even in the Republican Party, there are important voices that think that we should have a better relationship with Russia, and they include Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, who's a very senior Republican, worked for many years in the Reagan administration. He's now the chairman of a subcommittee of the House Foreign Relations Committee. Can you talk about Congressman Rohrabacher?
Yeah, the clip that I sent both of you guys the other night was, it's an RT segment that aired 3 or 4 days ago, and the title was, Can U.S. and Russia Work Together Against ISIS? And I was like, well, this is interesting. I have to click that. It turned out the guest on the show for an extended interview, which is one of the reasons I like RT, it was like a 20-minute long interview with Representative Dana Rohrabacher from California. He's a Republican, and he was talking about why Russia and the United States ought to work together against ISIS and for other international goals, and why it's been foolish all these years to kind of carry on the Cold War and pretend Russia is an enemy. And he was explicitly clear to say, you know, Russia is not perfect here. I'm not a Russian apologist. Russia has human rights violations as well, and they have free speech violations. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that both countries need to do better. But to pretend that the other is the enemy is just foolish. There's no reason why we can't accomplish greater things in the world if we work together. And he's been to Russia many times as a diplomat, and you know, he was just sort of going on about his fellow congressmen who believe fallacies, I guess, about Russia. He said that most Americans don't even know that there's freedom of religion in Russia. And he said with a false belief like that, how could we ever see Russia as someone we could work with?
It's worth noting that Putin just opened up one of the largest mosques. Actually, I believe it is the largest mosque in Moscow. It's interesting because from the point of view of many in the Middle East, especially, they view the West generally, and largely this through ignorance, as a place that is un-Islamic, a place that is not friendly to Muslims. By broadcasting this, what Russia is doing is demonstrating to the world, hey, we are not the Soviet Union of before. Because Russia does carry around the baggage of atheism, because the Soviet Union even had a ministry of atheism. But now he's demonstrating we're not the Soviet Union. We're a multicultural, multi-religious society open to all religions. And it's a very smart political coup for the Russians, because it does demonstrate that we're a modern Western, even almost capitalist, and I say almost because most of the industry is still nominally state-owned, if just not just owned by Putin's friends. You know, which most of it is owned by his friends, so it's not really capitalist, but still, it's not the atheistic state of the Soviet Union.
RT is the state news arm of Russia, so, you know, it's not entirely independent. So I think it's worth mentioning that the timeliness of a segment like this on RT is, the word suspicious isn't correct, but it's to say that...
It may be coordinated with...
It's coordinated, that's a good word.
Yeah, with Russian hopes for better relationship
with
the United States.
Exactly, and I'd say with all the motion happening right now with the potential working together, or at least their positioning in a way that they could work together against ISIS in Syria, the lifting of sanctions on Cuba, the working toward negotiations with Iran, that these are all sort of heading toward a position where we could open up friendly relations with Russia again. And like what Dana Rohrabacher was saying was that it's all been about NATO. It's all been about NATO's strength in the region to be unopposed against Russia, and that this is a false premise.
Yes.
So I think that Russia is making a concerted effort to reach the American people and say, we need to work together.
Gus, you've been following the presidential election, and you listened to the second Republican debate.
Against my will.
Against your will. You suffered through it. When it came to foreign policy, was there anything interesting? Were there any Republican candidates who appeared to be more receptive to a less strident foreign policy than the one that's been associated with the Republicans for many years?
Yeah, well, Kasich really surprised me in this one. He, I think, is kind of a bore, generally, and does not excite me very much, and he's really a very vanilla flavored conservative, you know, just sort of the party line on everything. But he really went out of his way to jump into the conversation on the Iranian treaty and seemed very well informed about the nuances of the treaty, unlike most of the people like, you know, Ted Cruz, who basically sort of prides himself on being a know-nothing ninny. Kasich went out to show good restraint. He aggressively supported the negotiations, and he sort of went out of his way to say they're not perfect, but nothing is. And there's no way that you're going to get the other side to give up everything and you give up nothing. I think that was a very level-headed approach, and it was very refreshing to me to see someone who I saw as just, like I said, a vanilla Republican come out and actually take an opposite stance to what his other comrades like Rubio and Cruz were saying. Oh, and Rand Paul definitely was on the same lane as Kasich there. He supports the negotiations, but he was a little bit more tepid about the way that the current treaty is worded, and he did say that he'll vote against it, but he did not say he's opposed to negotiating with Iran. It's just that he didn't like the way that this negotiation was worded. So, okay, that's a fair reservation. Rubio and Cruz and Fiorino all took the iron fist approach where it was no concessions whatsoever until they give up everything. We can't trust them. They're terrorists. And day one, as soon as they're president, it will be taken to the shredder. Rand Paul made a pretty strong point where he said if Obama had gotten his way in the beginning and went ahead and bombed them and Congress had voted in approved the bombing, you know, he said ISIS would be unchallenged in Syria today and that Syria would belong to ISIS. And, you know, I think that he makes a fair point there. I'm still waiting for an explanation as to why America has the sole responsibility of policing the war. That is sort of the premise that every conversation starts off with. Let's start with the presumption it's our job to fix everything that ails the world. Now, how will you do it?
I think the idea that we are fixing the world is something that is part of the white, the eyewash that's really meant to make the
fix
the
everything policy with a hacksaw and a sledgehammer.
The notion that we invade foreign countries always is part of some humanitarian mission. We all know that this is historically speaking not accurate. Countries don't engage in these wars.
Well, let's face it, that's like during the Prague Spring, the Soviets going in and saying, oh, we're here to help the working class and socialist revolution in the country and whatnot. Yeah, it's same kind of idea.
No, it's like the movie Mars Attacks, where the Martians are rolling down the street in their tanks and they're zapping everybody with their ray guns. And the announcement on the loudspeaker says, do not resist. We are here to help, as they're shooting everybody with ray guns.
Yes. Of course, there's another agenda, but I'm hopeful that this year we might have, hope springs eternal in this election cycle, we might have an intelligent debate on foreign policy, which has pretty much been absent in the past. And maybe we can get to some of the fundamentals, such as should we be hostile to Russia? Should we be encircling Russia by expanding NATO from 14 to 28 countries? Should we be intervening in Ukraine, which is, after all, within their buffer area, former part of the Soviet Union? Why is it important to us?
Well, I mean, you make a fair question, but one of the problems with the propaganda arm here is that the last debate was on CNN, and all the questions start with an air of presumption. For example, one of the questions that was asked to the candidates was, what would you do to stop Russia from supporting Syria? Okay, that's point blank. That's not even, is it okay for Russia to support Syria? Does it hurt American influence if Russia supports Syria? It's just, what would you do to stop it?
Yes.
Yeah. Starting with the presumption that it's a bad thing.
Well, that's how you really control public opinion, is
right.
By limiting the debate.
Right.
Well, Marshawn, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
The thing that we as the American people need to ask ourselves, and the thing we need to look for in our politicians, are we ready for a war with Russia? Because that's really what this boils down to at the end of the day. Because Russia is not going to let itself get hemmed in. It never has. I mean, Britain fought a bloody war over Crimea with the Russians. The Russians fought the Turks over Crimea and over other regions around, you know, Armenia and whatnot. What we really need to ask ourselves is, are we prepared for a confrontation with the Russians? We can cut a deal with the Russians. We can cut a deal with them. The Chinese, I'm a bit more worried about, because They have a lot of interest in the South China Sea, but if we would be on good terms with the Russians, the Chinese wouldn't move without Russian support. But the big issue that we really need to ask ourselves, and that none of the politicians seem to be asking themselves, is are we ready for a confrontation with the Russians? Because right now, militarily, we don't have the capacity to go to war with the Russians. Our military is smaller than it's been since before World War I. We also have to look at the fact that a potential war with the Russians could cost hundreds of thousands of American lives. If we're not prepared to pay that kind of price, we're really going in with our heads buried in the sand.
That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, IncontextReport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio for All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe and producer Gus Canavero, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.